granted asylum, and in 1 year she will be a legal permanent resident. But there are 23 other clients who at this point are vulnerable, and they are telling me that the temporary employees are terrified that they could get deported. And they're talking about numbers in the hundreds.
And your response to Eric Trump saying, we have thousands and thousands of workers. We can't know this stuff.
Sure. Well, no, that's not the case at the golf club. The golf club roughly has about 100 employees. And what the workers are telling me, half of them were undocumented in Westchester. And I would say the same for Bedminster. I understand the organization might have thousands, but the golf clubs themselves, each one of them that operates independently, has roughly about 100 employees. So we're talking about 500 employees in five golf clubs. Half of them are undocumented, possibly, according to what clients are telling me. And we haven't heard from other golf clubs in other parts of the United States.
Congress is doing an investigation?
Yes. We were there last week. We met with members of the House. We met with the Senator Booker from New Jersey and also Senator Menendez. I believe they are circulating a letter requesting not only a thorough investigation by the FBI, Homeland Security investigations, but also protections for these workers.
Annabelle Romero, I want to thank you for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Go ahead.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. And up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sexbots Cat Party on Saturday, February 9th at 9 p.m. at the Bit House Saloon in Portland. One-woman art pop trickster, The Sexbots, is back with a rap album about losing it and becoming a cat lady. This album has recurring themes of violence against women, street harassment, loneliness, and quietly watching one's life disintegrate. This event is the album release party and features kitty go-go's, a cat lady costume contest, and a pet psychic. Again, that's the Sexbots Cat Party on Saturday, February 9th at 9 p.m. at the Bit House Saloon, 727 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Well, here we go again. A winter storm watch is in effect for the Portland community. Forecasters expect a mix of rain and snow to start tonight and will continue through Friday evening before more snow hits this weekend. Portland could get as much as 4 inches of snow and possibly more through noon Sunday. The Columbia River Gorge could get as much as a foot of snow. The threat of another snowstorm follows one that slicked up roads Monday and caused schools and businesses to close in western Oregon and southwest Washington. The Columbia County Warming Center is open tonight from 8 p.m. till 8 a.m. at 125 North 17th Street in St. Helens. School buses in Clackamas County have been running on snow routes.
Some of our houseless neighbors near the 2nd and Burnside spoke with KBOO's Heather McCoy today. Here's that conversation.
Thank you so much, Sarah. May the Lord bless you more.
So I'm standing outside of the Portland Rescue Mission where a woman named Sarah was handing out cookies to some of the residents here. Right. I'm talking to somebody. I just met him. I didn't catch his name.
My name is Lolo, L-O-L-O.
Lolo. Cool. So how have you been surviving the really cold weather and outside?
By the grace of God.
By the grace of God?
Right.
Wait, do you have a hard time finding a warm place to stay, or are you...
And that is truth.
That is truth?
Because there's so many homelessness out here. Every time I come trying to get a bed, it's all in capacity. There's no room. So I got to sleep outside. They got only less beds, and it depends on what time you get here, then you get a bed. When you get a little bit later, number second, then you don't have a good bed. Then you sleep outside.
So for the rescue mission...
We need more beds. We need a new building for homelessness. Homelessness is a problem. Look around.
So
mayor of this city needs to what? Provide homes for the homelessness.
So to get a bed...
We need a budget for a shelter, big shelter to be rebuilt or built from scratch for homelessness. We are not homeless because of our choice. We are homeless because we have some things that are going on in our lives and it can be fixed.
Absolutely.
How gonna be fixed? Okay, let me say, I'm looking for a job, right?
Yeah.
Looking for a job. I need a home.
You say it makes it hard to find a job without
a home. That's they call your place. Look at me.
Yeah.
I haven't showered for 7 days. I smell like a fish. I don't deserve that. I'm an American citizen.
For the Portland Rescue Mission, what time do you have to show up to ensure that you get a bed for the night?
Well, according to them, they put their tickets away about 6:30. If you're later than that, then you don't get a ticket. Now what? What is the next option? Outside, on the street. I just slept yesterday outside. Look at me, shivering.
So how long have you been on the streets?
I've been on the streets since 2015.
Was it like a job loss, or how did this happen?
Yes. I lost my job. Okay. And after that, I lost my passport. I'm a nurse assistant. Lost my passport. It was a booklet. My passport, my social security, everything in there. I don't have identification. Yeah. Only ID. What's my passport? Somebody stole it from the street. My social security, my passport is stolen from the street. So therefore, somebody needs to help me, to pay me so I can get a passport.
So Multnomah County, when it gets this cold, they start up with a bunch of temporary shelters. Have you been able to access those?
Where are they at? Where are the temporary shelters? I don't see it. They say it. They tell the world that there's a temporary shelter. Where are they at? Where in Poland? How come I don't know about it? Give me the information so I could not sleep on the street anymore.
Yeah, so the information.
Where are the temporary shelters? Where are they at? Give me information.
I'll give you the information as soon as we're done with the interview. Well, I see lineups at the Portland Rescue Mission at 6 a.m. What are they in line for exactly?
Excuse me?
Oh, when I come by here at 6 a.m., I notice that there's a lineup going on outside of the Portland Rescue Mission.
Right.
What are they lined up for?
They line up to get in to sleep.
In the morning.
Comfortable to sleep outside?
No, I mean in the morning.
In the morning, the lineup, actually, when you go in there, I've been there like 2 days ago, I've been in there. They get you out at 5:30. You got to get out. And then you come back at 6:30 to line up to go back in. And then after you get in, you get breakfast and you get out. They don't let you stay there.
Have you worked with anybody to try to get you to transition to permanent housing, or?
Yes, TPI.
TPI?
Yeah. So my number is there, 120 for a bed.
Okay.
I may get a shelter some, I don't know when.
Yeah. So there's just not enough services then?
I'm just surviving right now by the grace of God.
Is there anything else you want to leave our listeners with?
I just want to tell the governor of Portland, Oregon, and the mayor to provide more room for the shelter, for the homeless shelters. We need shelters. There's a budget. Come on. We need more shelters.
Okay. Thank you again for your time.
You can catch the Heather McCoy Show on Thursdays from 10 to 11 a.m. here on KBOO.
A long list of shelters are open tonight. Here are just a few of them. The Union Gospel Mission is taking walk-ins on Northwest 3rd Avenue starting at 9 tonight. At the Walnut Park Winter Shelter on Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, you can reserve a spot by calling between 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. or walking into the Transition Projects Day Center on Irving Street. Rose City Park United Methodist Church Winter Shelter at Northeast Alameda Street is taking calls and website requests. And the Family Winter Shelter in Northwest Portland is available. You can call 9211 to be screened for eligibility.
A local group is trying to fight hate. I spoke to a local leader in the fight against hate. Here's the interview. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer with KBOO Evening News. We are speaking today with Carrie Coe from Portland United Against Hate, part of the city's Office of Neighborhood Involvement. Portland United Against Hate seeks to track, respond to, and prevent acts of hate while providing support for communities affected by hate. The Portland City Council is expected this week to sign a resolution denouncing white supremacy and alt-right groups in the city. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has said the resolution will attempt to reckon with Portland's past, a past she believes was built upon racism. Commissioner Hardesty hopes the resolution will help city employees map and understand Portland's hate groups, a step she sees as vital to protecting Portland's minority communities. Welcome, Carrie. Why does there need to be an explicit statement by the city denouncing these groups?
So it's really important that City Council and the community in general clearly and adamantly condemn white supremacy in values and action, because these groups and the actions that they take out there in the community are extremely prevalent. And if a very clear statement that this will not be accepted and that hate is not welcome in our community, then it essentially implicitly accepts those actions and those values. And so we see that coming out and making clear statements like this resolution are an effective way to essentially dampen the movement of the alt-right and of white supremacists in our community. It's not the only thing that we can do, but it's an important step.
Interesting. And how did it all come together for you?
It is a coalition of 65 community organizations, neighborhood associations, culturally specific groups in partnership with the city of Portland. And it really came together after the election of Donald Trump, when communities who are most targeted by hate, so community organizations that work with people of color, with the queer community, with religious communities, when they were being overwhelmingly tapped by members of the community who were experiencing hate violence in the streets every day. So there was a huge surge in hate violence after the election of the current president, and that led to those groups coming together to be like, what can we do to address this? Hate violence isn't new, white supremacy isn't new, but it is visible right now and aggressive right now in a way that we haven't seen in recent years. And so the coalition formed around that impetus to be like, how can we deal with hate violence in our community and directly support those who are being targeted? So the coalition has been working for the last 2 years on that, and doing a variety of projects and programs with the community and in partnership with the city.
Carrie, you're a renowned grassroots political organizer. What is your main focus in this work?
So my main focus in this work of Portland United Against Hate is actually making sure that the communities who are on the front lines of hate violence are leading the charge to end hate violence. So we know that there's a lot of things that can be done and a lot of action that has to be taken by many different people, but the leadership for how we address hate violence should come from the communities most directly affected. I think that's how we're going to come up with real solutions that impact people's lives and that make for a safe and vibrant Portland for all of us. So that's the focus of Portland United Against Hate. Not only are we sort of partnering with the city to figure out policy solutions and reporting and data tools, but we're really looking to an elevating communities on the front lines.
And what is happening in the city around hate crimes? Are there hot spots in the city that we should know about?
One of Portland United Against Hate's big projects right now is called reporthatepdx.com, and it is an online tracking tool for hate incidents. So we are just launching this project. It's brand new. It's currently a pilot, but it is our way of trying to figure out what those hotspots are and what is going on out there in the city. So right now there's no mechanism for tracking hate activity aside from hate crimes through the police department or the FBI. And we know that those are drastically underreported. And I think that there's good reason for that, right? People either don't realize that what's happening to them is worthy of reporting, or people aren't trusting the police or have had bad experiences with the police and so don't want to report to them. So our tool is essentially a pilot project to demonstrate that people will report what's happening to them if it is in partnership and led by trusted community organizations. And if their reporting is paired with being able to access support and resources. So at reporthatepdx.com, you can report a hate incident that happens to you. It doesn't have to be a crime. Criminality is not a factor. And you can access resources for support, like legal resources, advocacy, counseling, things like that.
What does this week's resolution against hate groups do?
So this week's resolution is a condemnation from City Council against white supremacists and alt-right hate groups. It vocally condemns them, and importantly, it adds an element of training city staff on the history and impact of white supremacy, which I think is a crucial component, that it's important to say the truth, right, that we condemn white supremacist action, and to back that up with funded action of how we're going to implement this in real life. So capacitating or equipping city staff to have the information and have the power to be part of the solution is a really important part of it. And I hope that it is named in the resolution, and I hope it continues on and becomes a funded component that's executed.
Whose idea was it to push this resolution forward?
That's a great question. I'm not sure who initiated it. It's being put forward by Commissioner Nick Fish and Mayor Wheeler. Mayor Wheeler's staff are the contact people, so I'm sure that he had a big role to play, but all the commissioners have been really vocal in supporting the resolution. As you know, one of the alt-right groups targeted, like specifically named Mayor Wheeler recently in one of their threats, and so I think that probably helped to create some fire around this resolution.
What do you see happening if it is signed, and what kind of street-level impact do you foresee?
That's an excellent question. I think that the street-level impact happens when words are followed with action. So I think the training of city employees is going to be really important, because there are thousands of people who work for the city of Portland. Many of them have community-facing roles. Many of them create policy that impacts people's lives. And all of this needs to be done through a lens of fighting white supremacy and racist hate violence. So the more that we can capacitate people who are making those decisions and who are interacting with the community to be doing that in a way that fights white supremacy, the better off we'll be. And I think that it does have an impact for the city and city council to state really clearly and really boldly that those the actions and values of white supremacy will not be tolerated in the city. So I think those two things together will have a, you know, will have a ripple impact in the community. I think that this also hopefully will initiate a discussion about what are the other things that the city needs to be doing to pursue this and to implement the vision of, you know, interrupting white supremacy.
So what is your office working on next?
So right now, we are really focused on reporthatepdx.com. We are launching this website and this tracking mechanism in which we're going to compile data and have some recommendations that come out at the end of the pilot project. So we are really encouraging everyone to report any hate incident that happens to them on reporthatepdx.com. And then the other pieces that we're doing is that we provide trainings and capacity building to communities and to other folks in the city and beyond around ending hate violence. So those are our big focuses at this moment.
How can people get involved in Portland United Against Hate?
So you can go to reporthatepdx.com to find out more information about us. Organizations who are in alignment with our values are welcome to join the coalition. We're a coalition of organizations. Right now we have 65 organizational members, and we're happy to take more members, and people can get involved in the work that way and participate in our work groups and our committees and help to move the work forward each day. Finding us on reporthatepdx.com will be a good way to connect.
Thanks so much for speaking with us today, Carrie.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Carrie Coe of Portland United Against Hate. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
A teenager in Oregon has filed a lawsuit against security guards at JCPenney and Clackamas Town Center Mall, accusing them of targeting him for what his lawyer calls shopping while black. Private security guards stopped and interrogated the 17-year-old at the mall after he went shopping at JCPenney's. The guards eventually let the boy go after he showed them receipts for all the items he had in his shopping bags. This follows a similar lawsuit that two teenagers filed this past fall against Lloyd Center security personnel for wrongfully accusing the teens of stealing sunglasses. Four other racial profiling lawsuits have been filed this month in the Portland area. The businesses where people are accused of racial profiling include Walmart, Nike, Red Robin, and Foot Locker.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the dangers of the freezing weather and how the houseless community in Portland will be affected. At 6, it's Rose City Native. Then at 7, it's Urban Funk. Tonight's weather: cloudy with a low of 26, winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's weather: cloudy with rain developing later in the day, high of 42, winds at 5 to 10 miles an hour, chance of rain 80%. Today in Black history, Frank Robinson, the first black manager in Major League Baseball, has died today. The quote of the day is from Frank Robinson himself. Quote, "I always tried to do the best. I knew I couldn't always be the best, but I tried to be."
This past Wednesday, a Salem police officer, Seth Thayers, was arrested on charges of possession of methamphetamine and two counts of theft. Thayers has been on administrative leave from the police department since October of 2018.
When you file your taxes, you might be expecting, even counting on, a refund. But this year could be different. Due to new tax laws, taxpayers could be in for unwelcome surprises. Oregon U.S. Senator Democrat Ron Wyden spoke out about this issue on the Senate floor, saying the problem could affect as many as 30 million Americans.
The first tax filing season under President Trump's mess of a tax law is upon us, and it looks like a whole lot of chickens are coming home to roost. Republicans jammed their tax bill through the Congress at record speed. pile driver legislating. The Trump tax bill was signed into law with a whopping 9 days to go before the 2018 tax year was set to begin. And after all of that land speed record timing, there were bound to be serious problems. There's a big one now that lots of Americans are reportedly waking up to. And they're waking up now that the tax filing season has arrived. The big tax refund that Americans have gotten used to, that could be a goner now that Trump's tax changes are the law of the land, and many Americans might owe the government money. Here's what this is all about. And as the ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, I am very troubled about the prospect of what's ahead, and I want to lay out my concerns. Now, most Americans have their taxes withheld from each paycheck, and the Treasury redoes the math on withholding every year. Obviously, the math gets more complicated when the Congress passes legislation like President Trump's tax law, which in effect triggers a tax policy earthquake. The outcome of these decisions about how much to take out of everybody's paycheck is clearly going to have a big impact. Here's where it looks like things went wrong, where it looks like the Trump team decided on scoring short-term political wins instead of protecting Americans from financial harm. 2018 was an election year. The Trump Treasury Department had a shiny new tax law on its hands, and there's no question they wanted it to impress. It sure looks like back in December 2017, the Trump administration decided to put politics first, lowballed the estimates of how much tax should be withheld from everybody's paychecks, and lure Americans into a false sense of security that they had gotten a big tax cut courtesy of Donald Trump. The prospect of the Trump administration buying American taxpayers off with their own money, that's what you are talking about here. It's as if the Trump administration figured when the other shoe drops and people are hit with penalties for underpayment, well, it'll be springtime 2019 and that election, that 2018 election, is going to be behind us. It could cause a lot of hurt this spring when people who typically get a big refund suddenly learn that they owe the government a check. Americans understandably want their taxes to be simple and straightforward and routine. You can understand why people would count on getting a refund when they've gotten roughly the same amount back for years and years.
That was Oregon Senator Ron Wyden speaking on the Senate floor about the unwelcome surprise millions of taxpayers could face this year, that they've underpaid their taxes and may not be getting the refunds they expect.
And Oregon senators say they want the Pac-12, ACC, SEC, Big Ten, and Big 12 to take action against sexual violence. Ryan Wyden and Jeff Merkley today asked the commissioners of the conferences to take serious steps to address what they describe as the misconduct and sexual violence within their athletics programs. In addition to Wyden and Merkley, the letter to the commissioners of the NCAA's Power Five conferences included the signatures of Senators Patty Murray, Maggie Hassan, Richard Blumenthal, Amy Klobuchar, Tina Smith, and Ed Markey. The senators say their request comes in the wake of the NCAA's decision to dissolve its commission to combat campus sexual violence in August of 2018 without considering or adopting solutions beyond actions already required by federal law. We are looking to your conferences to stand up for the thousands of young people who experience sexual violence on campus by cultivating a culture of safety, accountability, and respect for students' rights, the senators wrote. We believe that participation in athletics is a privilege, not a right.
New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey released a 14-page outline today of a vision for a Green New Deal, the plan Democratic Socialist Ocasio-Cortez campaigned on. It requires the federal government to transition the nation to a carbon-neutral economy in 10 years, one powered entirely by clean, renewable, and zero-emission energy sources. It requires initiatives to ensure a fair and just transition for all communities and workers. This includes a mission to promote justice and equity by stopping current, preventing future, and repairing historic oppression of indigenous communities, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialized communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, low-income workers, women, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities, and the youth. These goals would be supported through infrastructure developments that address climate change. The plan also addresses issues related to indigenous land rights and the development of public lands, limiting the abuse of eminent domain laws and requiring the consent from indigenous people for all decisions that affect their people and traditional territories. The plan acknowledges that these goals cannot be supported without a guarantee of universal access to employment, affordable housing, single-payer health care, free higher education and technical training, and stronger labor unions with greater inclusion and bargaining rights. The agenda proposed is co-sponsored
of Indigenous peoples. There's a new push to do exactly that from our neighbors to the north in Canada. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
The Canadian government has introduced a new law aimed at reviving and protecting Indigenous languages. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the new bill is about strengthening Indigenous culture.
It's called Bill C-91, the Indigenous Languages Act. It was introduced in the Canadian Parliament by the Minister of Heritage and Multiculturalism. He added that many Indigenous languages in Canada are endangered. The law will support and promote those languages and provide the money to do that. It will also help federal government institutions make better use of Indigenous languages by providing interpretation when needed or having documents translated. It would also provide educational material, written lexicons and dictionaries, and permanent records of Indigenous languages. And it would create a new position, the Office of the Commissioner of Indigenous Languages, who would protect the languages and raise public awareness. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde, says the new law is a very positive step.
Studies have shown that when you're fluent in your language, you're more successful in school. You know who you are and where you come from. And more importantly, I've also stated that it's linked to the right to self-determination. We need our own languages, our own lands, our own laws, our own people, our own identifiable forms of government. So it's really vital to our survival as First Nations people.
The government said the proposed new law was a collaboration with Native people during more than 50 sessions across the country. But the National Group for Inuit People called it disappointing and symbolic because it does not address their right to speak their language. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Washington state lawmakers approved a proposal to improve voting on reservations. The bill allows tribal members to use their tribal IDs for voter registration and register with non-traditional street addresses. Additionally, tribes could request voter registration sites and ballot pickup and returns on tribal lands. The bill passed the Senate Wednesday. A companion bill is in the House. Cedar High School in Utah will retire its Indian mascot after a vote by the Iron County School Board this week. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the board voted 3-2 to remove the Redmond mascot. The Tribal Council of the nearby Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah reportedly did not take a public position on the issue, but met with the school board last month seeking a tribal liaison to the board and the hiring of a diversity specialist. Residents of tribal lands on the northern plains are being warned of more life-threatening weather Thursday night and Friday. A weather forecaster says there could be a reprieve for the weekend. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
Some wind chills on the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate, and northeast South Dakota were in the 30 below zero range overnight. The city of Sisseton had a wind chill in the 70s below zero last week. Today, tribal lands belonging to the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate, and Flandreau Santee Sioux Tribe are under a blizzard warning through the evening. Wind chills could drop into the 40s below zero or colder overnight. But Jen Hacker with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, says the brutal temperatures may not be around for the weekend.
After we get through the secondary cold shot that comes through tonight into Friday, we actually do try to warm back up air temperatures at least up into the teens on Saturday, if that's considered warm for mid-February. And then we've got kind of a seesaw of temperatures, but still generally 10 to 20 degrees for highs through early next week.
Every reservation in the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Wisconsin have some kind of winter weather warning or advisory today. Those stretch into parts of Nebraska, Kansas, and Montana. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the Cape Evening News for Thursday, February 7th, 2019. Here are the main points again. A winter storm watch is in effect, which means there could be 4 inches to a foot of snow on the way in various parts of the Cape listening area. As that happens, local warming shelters are opening up. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Lisa Loving, Alex Wiedlinger, Emily Gresham-Beamer, and Heather McCoy. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineers are Evan West, Alex Wiedlinger, and Rachel Hartley. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and a transcript of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Emily Gresham-Beamer. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 9, Positively Revolting Talk Radio, host Ani Haynes takes your calls. At 10, Beloved Community host John Shuck's guests are from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. At 10 on Valley Views, host Dale Holliday shares her observations about being a woman who is child-free by choice. This is part one of a two-part series. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide with Rabia Yaman looks at issues of science, technology, and humanity. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
As the cold weather rolls in and again this week, many services that help the houseless are stepping up. Some have small armies of dedicated volunteers. One such group is Sunnyside Community House. It's at 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. This building has now evolved into a place where our neighbors can gather for warm room meals and even theater performances and poetry readings. Joining us live right now at the KBOO Studios is John Mayer, the Executive Director of the Sunnyside Community House. Thank you so much for being here today, John.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
It's been pretty busy. You had like dozens of people there last night, right?
Tell me about it. Yeah, the last 4 nights we've been open as the cold snap sets in, and last night I believe we had 46, 47 people spend the night.
And you're expecting more of the same tonight, huh?
More of the same. We're looking at the forecast. We expect to be open for the next 2 weeks. There's not a day that the colds rise above freezing at night, so we're going to try and keep it going.
Yeah. Tell us about the Sunnyside Community House. I know there's kind of a long story about how it all started and where it is today.
Sure, yeah. It started a long time ago in 1911. The Methodist Church built it as Sunnyside Community House way back when. And they always held a vision that it would be a church centered in the neighborhood and be a community center that was open to larger than just like the traditional Sunday congregations. So for a long time, they ran school programs. They built a basketball court up on the third floor that we still have access and use of. So they put a lot of life into it. And it was a thriving congregation for over 100 years. And then in 2015, the congregation had dwindled, I gather. It was before my coming into the building. And the congregation folded. So that's a formal and process that follows some steps, and that hands the ownership back to the larger Methodist conference. And usually when that happens, the property would be sold. They're not really interested in being landlords. But the work wasn't done in the building. And so it was saved from sale and allowed to kind of be in this in-between process right now of time, the last 3 years, where we've been just putting the nose down and getting good work done and using the space well, and we'll see where it's going to lead in the next 10 years.
Saving it for the community.
Nice, yeah. And a cornerstone of what you do is called the Hard Times Supper on Wednesdays, going on for about 38 years. Tell us how that works and who you help.
Sure, yeah. So the Hard Times Supper was founded and continues to be run largely by Pat Schweibert. Pat Schweibert is a longtime advocate for homeless and many other people in need in Portland, a real local hero who would hate to hear her name mentioned as a hero on the radio. She has just put all of her being into doing good. And this has been the cornerstone of her work. So she has served meals every Wednesday herself for 38 years. Mm. She missed one last year in the big ice storm that she couldn't get to. That consistency has formed a community. So we serve between 120 and 150 people dinner every Wednesday night. We see almost all the same people Wednesday after Wednesday. And some of those people have told me that they've been coming for 20 plus years and have long time relationship with Pat and the building and the work that's happened. So we have an influx of volunteers and sometimes more than we can handle. And we put out a good meal and stay warm for a couple hours.
And a big part of what you do is in emergency weather conditions, like what we're talking about coming up this weekend. Tell us about some of the ways that you help people in difficult weather conditions.
Sure. So regardless of the weather, we open a day shelter from 1 to 4, 4 days a week, in addition to the supper. So that has folks coming in and doing projects and research on computers and just having a warm place to be. So as it gets cold, we just extend those hours as much as our volunteers can handle. It also, when it gets to emergency level, it allows us to open our shelter doors as an emergency warming shelter. We can't do that until it gets too cold, which is kind of a funny rule in Portland. It has to be cold enough that you're allowed to help folks in your space. So we watch the weather closely. And as we see the temperatures dipping, we put out the word for volunteers. And so we now have, I guess we're on the fifth night. Tonight's night 5 of this run, and it'll be, I think, our 12th night being open since December.
Wow. And are you seeing more of a demand for services when the weather turns cold?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I would say that we see all of our folks that we're used to knowing and seeing will come in as things get cold. So it's not as if there's tremendous new demand that's happening, but it's like everybody that is in need will be in need during that time.
Mm-hmm. You're dealing with these folks all the time. How would you describe the current situation with the houseless community in the Portland area?
Dire. It is a dire situation. Mm-hmm. I think that it's well recognized we're in an emergency in this city. There's not enough shelter beds for everybody who wants one. The shelters that do exist don't exist in ways that can help everybody. They have rules that may keep people out, or people may choose not to engage in those shelters. And then the services that we have to support outside of shelters are, you know, everybody who is doing this work is doing great work, but there is not the infrastructure to make a tremendous change like is needed. Or at least I don't see the muscle going in that direction.
What kinds of things do you think could make that situation better?
Well, I think on a city level, I think we need to recognize that folks who are living on the street are our neighbors, and they deserve the same rights and respect and help that any one of us would expect from our public officials, from our police department, from our service agencies. And that's just not the case. It's not the case that everybody is treated the same. They are often, the folks that I'm friends with are often moved from one place that they can set up a camp to another fairly quickly. Their possessions are often taken. They are constantly in a feeling of defensiveness, which I can't quite wrap my head around living defensively 24/7. I think there's a lot that the city could do to say we recognize that we have something that we could offer more than police and enforcement of rules.
Yeah, and what can people do if they are in need of help and need shelter?
So 211 is a great resource as it gets cold. So calling 211 either for yourself or on behalf of somebody else will give you a list of the open shelters that are going throughout that night. And there is an orchestration of transportation that can come with that as well to get people where they need to go. Outside of that, asking communities where help is offered, and finding your ways to folks, you know, places like ours, and knocking on the door. We're not going to turn anybody away.
And on the other side of that, people who are listening to this might be thinking, I want to get involved with helping to solve the problem. And I know you rely on lots of volunteers. So sure. What can people do if they want to help their neighbors?
Yeah, I think help your neighbors is a great way to phrase it, because as individuals, or even as, you know, as Sunnyside Community House, we are not going to solve the homelessness problem in Portland. We are not going to make this problem disappear, and we don't pretend that our services are going to take homelessness numbers down. But we do know that people need their basic needs met. So I think looking for organizations and opportunities to volunteer at whatever comfort level people are. And that could be anything from, you know, organizing a sock drive, which we always need more socks and underwear, and dropping it off and knowing that you're helping a good effort, to pitching in a couple of dollars, to giving a night of your time, to staying awake and making sure that, you know, 40 or 50 people can be safe and warm inside. Anybody would be welcome to contact me at any time and find a way to volunteer and hook into things. But short of going into a shelter or going into a situation where you can help in a formal sense, I think all of us know a few homeless faces around our neighborhoods. And I think it would be a tremendous effort to ask folks' names and give people a place to tell a story, and begin to see that those regular faces are just as regular as the person who owns the house next door, and build a community that knows one another's names.
Right. And there was a time, speaking on that, when there was a time when the community center was at risk of being sold to private developers. What happened to stop that?
Well, some people within the church would say, you know, God was at work and helped to stop it. God wasn't done working in the church. And so as the church congregation left, there was still work to be done. Others would say community organized and said, we want this space to continue to exist for good. We've organized ourselves under a motto of learn, serve, and gather. And so that's what we try and bring people together under those three auspices and use our space for that.
Now, in your background, you actually were an elementary school teacher before you got into this, and you've been involved with the homeless community for about 2 years. And based on what you have seen, what works and what doesn't work in terms of tackling the homeless crisis here in, sure. in Portland?
So services work. Allowing people to take a shower, have a bathroom, have access to mail, a mailing address where they can get something as simple as an ID. Again, knowing people's names works. I have de-escalated what look like fight situations just simply by calling one person's name. I had an experience early in volunteering when I saw a lady that I was familiar with get off the bus in my neighborhood, and I said hi to her, hi Donna. And she turned and gave me the most humongous smile and told me that that was the first time somebody had called her name all week. And so I think that those efforts can be done all the time and anywhere.
That's amazing, and it's really wonderful to hear. You know, we have the winter storm watch in effect near Portland. We wanted to mention that again. It's in effect until 4 o'clock on Saturday. Now, how is that going to impact what you're seeing over the weekend at the Sunnyside Community House? What do you expect?
We expect to be busy.
Yeah, I bet.
Nice. We're just going all the time right now, actually. So I would expect that we will be doing laundry 24 hours a day. I'm going to expect probably about 40, maybe 50 people there tonight. I think that as the cold snap grows, we'll see more and more people. We run our shelter so that we, if somebody is there one night, we promise them their space and their blankets and bags and such the next night. And so there's a consistency that grows with that too. I think that I'm starting to experience an increased kind of like ownership and want to help from folks that we're serving too, which has been lovely. So people are picking up a broom or a mop or asking what they can do to help. You know, we're spending a lot of time together inside, and sometimes it can feel a little like a strange summer camp experience because we know each other very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the center has also evolved into a place that showcases the arts. Mm-hmm. What are some of the performances and programs you have hosted?
Yeah, so we give home to four kind of small, medium-sized community theater companies.
Nice.
We have a chorus that practices and puts on a performance. So recently they did a big solstice performance that was lovely at the end of December. We have the Old Sanctuary is a really wonderful acoustic and aesthetic space. And so we have concerts that happen there occasionally. We have a music group that does, My Voice Music does music camps for kids. And so they put on their showcase on our sanctuary stage each summer. We just had a Fertile Ground play. It was part of the Fertile Ground Festival last two weekends that was going on the stage. So it kind of feels like things are happening all the time. And rehearsals are going on, you know, in each corner of the space. So.
That's really wonderful. Awesome. We're joined by John Meyer. He's the executive director of the Sunnyside Community House, in case you're just joining us here on KBOO. I was looking at a list of some of the services your folks have provided. 18,000 plates of warm food, 2,500 showers, 20 nights of emergency weather shelter, an active clothing, blanket, sleeping bag exchange with thousands of articles that are passed out. How is that even possible? It just sounds like an army must be involved here.
It does feel that way. And again, I'm going to use Pat's name because she makes it all possible. Her experience of knowing kind of what, expecting what the needs are and being able to stock both the pantry and the linen closet or the clothing closets is incredible. So we put out the word for what the needs are. We have people who are kind of watching, you know, the dollar store and Value Village and the bins, and they know we need 32 to 36 size pants, and so somebody will bring us a giant bag of those. Pat is at the food bank almost every day, filling her van and coming and then orchestrating meals and helping us know, you know, something good to cook. We always run on the principle that we won't serve anything that we wouldn't serve our family. So that we follow that model of good food for good people. We try and, in response to some of the neighborhood concerns around messes of homeless camps and such, we change our clothing and blankets program into an exchange. So we ask folks to bring back what they either find or have that's wet and dirty and soiled, and we'll wash it up. And if it's usable, we'll put it back out for somebody else. But that enables us to keep it in trade. And some folks really kind of enjoy bringing in a couple of blankets for us and then being able to take something dry out. We do laundry, I'd say 24 hours a day, it feels like. We say yes as much as possible. When I very first started, I had this thought the first time somebody asked me for seconds of a meal that maybe we should wait. Is there going to be enough? And then quickly, you know, somebody swooped in and said, oh, of course we have seconds. And then I learned the whole process is to be able to say yes. You need a to-go box? You want a little extra?
Yeah.
You don't like the salad? you need a second blanket? Oh, you don't like wool blanket? You know, like, we're trying to meet people's needs in a humane way.
Yeah.
The same as I might expect if I were to go, you know, to a middle-class establishment that was currency transactions.
Yeah. And you've even added a small computer lab with donated computers. How was that helpful to folks in our community?
Yeah. So shout out to Catlin Gable School. They gave us five computers.
Oh, that's great.
And we put out two at a time and give access to internet. And so folks have used that, you know, anything from entertainment, which is, you know, just what I use my computer for, to researching, signing up for Oregon Health Plan, you know, finding ways to get eye exams. The guy Chuck was just teaching me about a way to get free eye exams if you're low income, checking your email, seeing if somebody's got a message that they wanted to send you, really basic stuff. And then we hope to grow that, you know, if we have volunteers that can help us man it or offer a service or a teaching, those kind of pop up and as volunteers make themselves known.
Mm-hmm. One more time, if people want help or they want to help out at the Sunnyside Community House, what should they do?
I suppose the easiest way is to shoot me an email, info@sunnysidecommunityhouse.org, or you could find us at that website. All the information's there, including my cell phone, which seems to ring nonstop with, you know, folks who want to give and help, which is really wonderful. You can also just stop by. I'm there 8 to 3 almost every day, and as we're in this cold snap, people are there almost all the time. We're in the basement, and if you come say hi, we'll direct you. And if you're cleaning out your closet and you notice you have a blanket that you're not using, or a jacket that you're not using, or something waterproof, or a sleeping bag, there is somebody that I can put it in their hands, and they will be very thankful for having it.
What do you like the best about this kind of work?
I like that I could make a list 3 pages long of ways that I know that I have helped an individual each day. I think that to put yourself in the way of doing something good is a satisfying way to live. I find that my sense of neighbors has been expanded exponentially since I began this work, and I have so many more friends of such a wide swath of our city that I feel like I never considered in a true human sense. I knew that the folks that were sitting on the corner were consistent. I didn't have any disregard for them, but until I started asking folks names and getting to know their stories, I realized that I hadn't really considered them fully my neighbors, and that's been a radical change that I'm very thankful for.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment where you had like an epiphany, where you'd been a teacher for a long time, so you were definitely giving back to the community that way, but where you decided to take those same gifts and go in another direction and help the houseless community?
No.
I found
myself there in a grief space.
Yeah.
And I was in a deep grief space, and I met Pat and was offered an opportunity to do some good in my neighborhood in a way that was something that just felt like in that moment it's all I could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so and then that's grown into this sense that I don't know, maybe I am still a teacher, but I right now this feels like the work that I'm supposed to be doing.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, totally. And what else would you like listeners to know regarding the houseless community and how else they can help? What things that you think that people should be discussing together in order to get this news out?
Sure. I guess I would just add probably, I won't add, I'll just reiterate the point that we are a community if we allow ourselves to be. And the size and nature of that community is up to those who are part of it to make it a little bit bigger. And folks who are living on the street are there for a myriad of reasons. Some of them will get off the street. Some of them never will. Some of them want to. Some of them articulate that they don't right now. But whoever they are, they're just like you and me in need of a listening ear, a hug now and again, a place to land a story. And any of us can be that person in any sort of context we find ourselves in.
Wonderful message of hope there. Well, thank you so much for joining us today for KBOO News in Depth.
Thanks for having me.
John Mayer is the executive director of the Sunnyside Community House, which offers programs to help the houseless, and you can find the house at 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. And if you'd like more information, you can check out their website. Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO es un orgulloso copatrocinador de la temporada de conciertos de Portland Folk Music Society 2018-2019. Tish Hinojosa es la artista principal para el concierto del 15 de febrero, el cual se llevará a cabo en la iglesia Redwood Friends en Portland. Las canciones de la compositora y cantante Tish Hinojosa son una mezcla de americana, western,